laws of nature. So we offer the explanation for the root of anti-Semitism and the solution to it. If you don't believe us, you can listen to the first 22 episodes of our podcast, available anywhere. And then you can also listen to the rest of our videos and some of the other great content. So don't take our words for it. Definitely listen and challenge us. We'd like a good challenge. But so far, whatever we've been doing hasn't been working. However, I will say that I had the privilege to sit with a lot of people, thinking people, you know, not just, you know, the people who, you know, whose job it is to think, come up with ideas, write, produce, make, right? Like people in those, not web influencers. God bless them, right? But people who actually, you know, they work at putting things together, projects, and executing things, and then, you know, making things move. They're like, and one thing is, certain people are concerned, urgently concerned. I don't think they really get the urgency of what's going on. Especially these past few days, everything that's been happening in Israel, the sort of the slowing down of the war, but ramping up of American efforts against the government here, and all this stuff around, and you feel like it's like this all out quagmire, like we're not coming out of anything, like nothing good is coming out of any. It's like what's that, Ebola? Like we just have to bleed from every hole. It's kind of a little bit. I'm sorry, kind of like that. So. On the one hand, the ship feels like it's sinking, or maybe sinking faster. And I'm saying it, you know, with a smirk, but it really is kind of a frightening thought. It feels like a sort of a final duel at noon. And then on the other hand, people are asking questions and they're more open. I was sitting in dinner the other day and I was talking to people about what we think should happen, right? Like how Jews should put their, you know, put all their efforts on banding to make everything that's good about Jewishness really shine above everything else, which is another way of saying that the way we are able to come together and sort of rise above our differences and cover them with love and put everyone around the proverbial Shabbat table, all of that, to actually do it. You know, all the parties, all the religious streams, all the viewpoints, all the everything, just show the world we can do it, and that will start a chain reaction, a good chain reaction. And people used to just not, you know, tune out. Then they would say, oh, it's crazy. Now I got responses like, oh, you're such an optimist. How will we do it? Questions like that, which is better, you know. It's so there is a movement. I don't know, how is it on the U.S. side? Does it feel like things are moving, or... Are people packing? Are people disconnecting more from Israel? Like, what's the? I don't know. We haven't spoken.
Okay, so I don't really know what's going on in the heartland. I'm not that in touch with what's going on in the heartland. I think there is. I heard Alan Dershowitz this morning saying that the majority of Americans do support Israel and not Hamas, but I think that. A lot of Jews of means, you know, like retired Jews, that kind of baby boomer generation, I think a lot of them are very disconnected. There's no skin in the game. They don't have a connect real strong. They're happy to be Jews or proud to be Jews, but they're not going out on the line. They're not putting themselves on the line. I think that, yeah, I mean, even half of them, you know, are Biden supporters, half are Trump supporters, but there's no skin in the game, because I think that maybe they feel nothing's going to happen to them, and probably nothing's going to happen to their kids. And so just let's ride this out as long and just enjoy. Oh, I don't hear you.
So World War II, just, you know.
No, it's too far. It's too far. It's too far. Yeah, it's too far away. I went on a college visit yesterday with my youngest. We went to a school down south, and there was we ran into a Palestinian protest. You know, like they were protesting pro-Palestine even down south. Yeah, I think it's I don't think it's looking good for us.
Again. Push your mic out a tiny bit. Still a little hot. Well, there's no question that this the anti-Semitism card is being also passed around and used in many ways, and for sure you can see that whole thing being played out in many ways. Like if you look at it through the political lens, it's one thing. Through the choose on campus lens, it's another thing. Through the geopolitical game, it's not yet another thing. Economically, like it pops up everywhere, but not always in exactly the same way, and not always used by the same actors. But it seems like a good joker to have, and I hope we're going to be able to shed some light on that, because we've invited a former guest on the Jew Function. He was last time he was here. He talked about it. His last book. I think it was called Jexit, the Jewish exit from America. And we talked about that book. Yeah, from the left, I'm sorry. I was already like, all right, and they're on the boat. From the left. And now he's got a new book. It's called The Anti-Semitic, sorry, it's called The Anti-Semitic Imagination, The Great Establishment Deception. So I'm very happy to have on the show once again, sociologist, and podcaster, fellow podcaster, Charles Moskowitz. Please help us open our minds. Tell us what's happening in your world. Hi, Charles.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it as always. I'm following the show. It's great. You know, you guys are doing really cutting edge things. I don't think anyone's doing it quite the way you do. So, you know, I really congratulate you for that.
That's a compliment.
I feel more positive, in a sense, with regard to present developments with the Israel-Hamas war, only in that right after the brutal invasion of Israel, of which was, by any definition, a genocidal attack, there was concern that Israel as a society had kind of, as they say, jumped the shark. I mean, that the Israelis didn't have that unity. They didn't have that ability to come together and defend themselves and define themselves. And that's proven to be completely false. Israel is very united today. The society is united. The people from all diverse political backgrounds are united. They put aside their differences. And I think because of that, and this, of course, is in the face of the usual anti-Israel sentiments that I would argue emanate from the international leftist establishment, but also from the far right, and I could get into both of those. But in spite of that, Israel soldiers on, and that it's an opportunity right now, a learning opportunity for the Israelis and for the Jewish people generally to define where we are, who we are, what we stand for, a couple of basic principles of what we believe in, and to perhaps do a bit of an internal kind of, cleaning, a cleansing of perhaps ideas and principles that we may have embraced, that may have been ascribed to us, that have not been in our best interest, and to identify those fearlessly and out of a sense of strength, as opposed to being defensive about it. So in my book, I define anti-Semitism both left and right, but I also defined internal problems within the Jewish fabric, as it were, that I think ultimately are the best way to address both of those anti-Semitic forms, which are predominant. Which problems?
What Jewish problems?
Well, I think internally we have forgotten the basic principles, many of us, of what it means to be a Jew and what Judaism actually is. And I think that at a time of such stress, it's a great idea for us to visit those questions and see, what principles unite us? What principles do we fall upon? Why are we here? What is the mission of the Jewish faith and the Jewish people? And is it valid? And I think if we can come to terms with that, we can not only understand ourselves, but our enemies on left and right in the Arab world, wherever, we'll be able to handle them. You know, that we will be able to confront them and continue to confront them with more resolve.
Let's make this Jewish mission a cliffhanger, put it slightly further in the future of this talk today. And before we get into it, because, you know, that's what we're all about. But before we get into that, I'm just curious this book, you started working on this book before the 7th, I imagine.
I did, yeah.
Right. So how, you know, to tell me a little bit about, I'm curious, tell me what's, you know, package for us, the essence of this book. I know that you're quoting C. Wright Mills. I haven't read the book. I would love to get a copy and read it. But I saw that you're quoting Mills, and you're talking about this anti-Semitic imagination, sort of something that happens almost disconnected from the actual Jews, some event in the hearts and the minds of people. So I'm curious, what made you write this book, or how did you get to write it? And has the events on the 7th, have they changed, they affected the content of this book?
Well, I think that like most of us, and I would probably include you guys as well, we all sense that this event of October 6th was in the works or something like it. It was like, you know, a volcano getting ready to erupt. And I sensed these forces out there that were absolutely anti-Semitic and what they were about. So I delved into it as a social theorist, but also as a historian. I looked at the origins of Christian anti-Semitism, Muslim anti-Semitism, establishment anti-Semitism, and also the history of Zionism, because it's been so misportrayed by enemies of the Jews, what it is, what the movement actually is. And in the process, I looked at a lot of the conspiracy theories that are promoted both by the left and the right, and I answered those to the best of my ability. And in the context that they are attempts, often sincere attempts, to understand the nature of our world and to understand many of the problems that come up that are hard to explain or hard to hold on to. And the result has been, of course, that they have shifted the blame to the Jews as the scapegoat. It's a convenient way to deflect attention and an easy way to answer things. But I also would argue that it became, and historically was, an easy way for a ruling establishment, whether it be a government or influential institutions, to deflect attention away from their own malfeasance by saying, oh, well, it must be the Jews. Excuse me?
Is there anything new about that?
No, this goes way back. And
it sounds, correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds as if like once anti-Semitism got going, but the Jews kept staying, everybody in power was like, hey, oh, look at that. That's like a very easy, you know, we can always pull that card.
Exactly.
Something goes wrong, just throw it on these guys.
What they took was normal.
Get out of jail, right?
Yeah. And they took normal anti-Semitism, which I'm not here to endorse, but it's things like the fact
mean the healthy kind.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the fact that we are deviant in society because we're a minority. We're not the mainstream of society. So there's always going to be some suspicion. Who are these people? Why are they different? And that combined with the fact that we have generally a record of being very successful due to our family values, our value of education, our independence, our ability to think on our feet, our ability to admire material achievement along with spiritual achievement. And we're very cohesive and united as a people. We help each other. So as a result, among other things, we are fairly successful as a people. So that results in a natural degree of envy and jealousy and all those deadly sins. And that's all well and good. I mean, and the answer to that, of course, is love. We need to reach out to people and show them that we're regular people just like they are.
Are we actually regular people like everyone else?
Yes. I mean, we need to rely on the Jewish value of compassion.
Why are we regular people like everyone else? That's challenging.
Well, because all human beings are created in the image of God. We're all regular people. Of course, you might be implying.
Is a lung the same as a kidney?
No, but they all function together to make a whole person. And Seth, I think you might be implying an issue that I also get into, which is, what is this concept of chosenness? Why are we the chosen people? Or is this, or is
what are we chosen for?
Yeah, in Fiddler on the Roof, I think Tevye looks to heaven and he goes, can you choose somebody else for a day?
Yeah, exactly.
But the point is that is, you know, it's a misunderstood premise, including misunderstood by many Jews, in that we are chosen, and we were chosen at Sinai to be a priestly sect and to serve God, not to rule over other people. We were there to take on an extra layer of observance, an extra ritual layer, an extra moral and ethical layer in our society as a way to know God, as a way to rise our spiritual condition so that the world can know God, so that we could be a light unto the nations. So we're not serving, we're not trying to control the world. That's one of the great anti-Semitic misconceptions, and one of the misconceptions by some Jews, I might add. We are, our mission as a people is to serve God and to know God and to walk with God.
Many of us aren't trying to rule the world, but you don't know about the guy who runs BlackRock and...
Well, you see, that's where you have an issue, because there are Jews who have become a part of this sort of physical world order entity that is trying to rule the world, and that is antithetical to Jewish principles, and that the Jews that are involved in that have fallen away from this basic understanding. They have suddenly believed that they are messiahs, in a way, secular messiahs, in that they've got some kind of a moral right to control others and to create a physical world in their image, not in the image of God. The Torah tells us in the book of Genesis, man and women, it says, are created in his image. We're not gods. These people think they're gods. We are images of God. We are equal under God. We ultimately all go back to God, or we come from God. We're all equal in that way. And that we are not here to rule over our fellow man. We are here to create a moral and ethical society based upon the principles and precepts of God as delivered at Sinai.
So how close are we to that ideal?
Yeah, or just what can we do about that?
Well, obviously Jewish history and the whole narrative of the Torah and Talmud and right up till today is our own struggle to know God. We get closer to God, in which case we become more holy and we become more successful in the material world. And then we fall away from belief in God and we start embracing idol worship and sin, in which case we fail and we fall apart. And that is a microcosm of the condition of all of humanity.
Let's just slow it down a little bit. So idol worship, like, what is modern idol worship?
Modern idol worship is worship of the state, is worship of utopia. There is, it's no longer a graven image. It's now, you know, we're going to worship, and it's becoming, I mean, every modern movement that has tried to deny God and create a earthly utopia, those modern movements include communism, Nazism, radicalized version of Islam, which I get into in another one of my books, which is not conventional Islam. And today, the international elites who are very much a part of this agenda and who are atheistic and who believe that they have a moral right to not only create law and moral and ethical law, but to create reality. Like, they have tools that are unprecedented.
Harari kind of people?
Yeah, like Harari, like the World Economic Forum, all of that, the Council on Foreign Relations, this whole international elite establishment is, they have tools now that Hitler could have only dreamed of in the form of artificial intelligence, the manipulation of the internet, transhumanism.
Radio. Everyone had a radio in their home, and he just fed them every day.
Yeah.
So it's pretty close.
That's right. It's like Chinese water torture. They dribble. I mean, they have learned techniques of psychology that can control people's emotions on a mass scale. The Nazis really perfected that. And they have tools in their hands that threaten this principle of that is eminent and basic to Judaism, which is that we are sovereign individuals who derive our sovereignty from the great sovereign of heaven. We are created in the image of God. We are not gods. we can improve our lives by knowing God, not by forcing other people to conform to what we think is a good image.
No, you kind of throw that word out there. You're not talking about some necessarily a religious manifestation of that, if I understand correctly. I mean, you don't strike me as like an Orthodox person.
Right.
So what? Tell me about that relationship with God. What is it about? Is that mentioned also in your book? Is the existential issue of anti-Semitism tied also to the existential question of God?
Well, I mean, I think that it's the whole structure and means of knowing God is described in the Torah and elaborated on in the Talmud in terms of how to pray, how to believe, how to structure your life in a way that is holy. It's a practical faith. It gives us basically a manual for how we are to conduct ourselves in business, in family, in personal relationships, in sexual relationships, in national relationships. And the only command in terms of earthly power that the Torah does clearly state, I would argue, is the command for the children of Israel to take possession of that tiny little swath of beachfront that we call Israel. That is in the Torah. It permeates the Torah. This is something that the Naturei Karta people don't seem to understand, as they say their Torah true. The Torah, every book of the Torah talks about the command that God gave us to take possession of that tiny land. Now, why did God do that? I don't know. I mean, that's a heaven question. But
why
that's...
To annoy everyone. The same book also talks about a bush that burns. The same book also talks about a sea that split and a snake that talks. So I'm with you. I share your opinion about this.
Right.
But it does. We're not going to open it all up now, but it does require more explanation, opening up, because...
Or at least a more internal, symbolic look at things, at least, for starters, rather than...
What do you mean, Leo?
What's that? No, I mean, look. If the problem is when you speak about those things and you say, okay, it's the word of God and it's all truth and it's all happened, that tends to push half the population away. But the more you actually try to read into these, as you said, as an internal struggle of an individual and of a nation, talk about it in those terms. Forces inside of you.
What does it mean to live in the land of Israel?
Well, I think that.
Okay,
sure. I mean, first of all, I get into the history of Zionism in my book, and I want to note for people who are listening to this broadcast who are either not Jewish or who don't understand this, that Zionism is a simple movement, nothing more and nothing less. It is the national and religious aspirations of the Jewish people to take possession of that land and to create a commonwealth there. It's both religious and secular. The borders of Israel are clearly delineated in the Torah from Dan to Beersheba, from the river to the sea. And that is exactly where Israel is today. So that is, it's nothing more than that. It's not this, people have this imagination of the Zionists creating a world government. I listen to anti-Jewish talk all the time. I heard this one guy say recently, it's this Khazarian conspiracy, which I got into in my book, that's trying to create a Jewish state in Ukraine and all this. You know, these crazy, that's not Zionism. That's the anti-Semitic imagination. Zionism is just sovereignty in that tiny piece of land, which is modest and proper, and which, according to the agreement arrived at between Emir Faisal and Chaim Weizmann in 1917, when he recognized Israel, or Jewish Palestine, as it was called then, that the only condition would be that the Israelis respect the rights of the Muslim minority, and that they respect Islamic religious sites, which Israel does, not perfectly.
By the way, they have pictures of letters from all the holy sites that say we are built on Jewish land. Like they have that,
right?
from the 20s, the 30s.
Well, if we want to talk about genetics, I mean, not that I we need to, but I would imagine that Arabs who have ancestry there probably were at one point Jewish, you know, if you want to go back many centuries.
But let's say this is all right? And let's say it's indisputable. Somehow the whole world agrees with us that it's indisputable that that's our ancestral homeland, right?
Right.
So next, so, and suppose they give it back to us, right? And they agree and they give it back to us, right? Imagine the next day that the Cheyenne Indians come and say, Minnesota is our ancestral homeland and we want it back.
Well, first of all, nobody gave anything back to the Jews. The Jews achieved it.
Let's suppose that the Jews, that it's agreed. The whole world says, you know what? Look at this coin. You guys were here 2,000 years ago. Look at this artifact. You guys were here 3,000 years ago. Look at this 500 years ago. You're right. We made a mistake. You can have this land. It's your sovereign land. We're giving it back, right? Just imagine
sure,
that happens
sure.
on Jan 1. Jan 2, the Cheyenne Indians say, we were in Minnesota, and we would like it back. What do you do?
Well, it's a broader issue than simply an indigenous question, which, of course, the Jews are indigenous to Israel. It's also the fact that every generation since the time of the destruction of the Second Temple and the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, which wiped out Jewish villages in Judea, right up to the Declaration of Independence in 1948, has had a Zionist movement. I get into this in detail in my book. Every generation, every century, there has been attempts to reobtain sovereignty in that country. And eventually...
I'm trying to pull something else out of you. I'm trying to pull out of you, is there more than just a yearning to return to your land? Regardless of how consecutive it's been, or how nonstop it's been, or how long it's been,
right.
Is there something more than just these people? Like, for example, if we can just say, if the whole earth is like a human body, right? These ones belong to the lungs, stick them back in the lungs. These ones belong to the spleen, stick them back. Put all the people back where they belong, kind of thing, right? But is there more? Is there something else, or that's just what it is? Because if we get ours,
right,
then let's just put everybody back where they belong. Everyone who says this was mine, let's just be sober about it. Where does everyone belong, and just put them there?
The only thing that I might just quibble with you a bit here is that nobody put the Jews there. The Jews put themselves there, and they did it based upon great sacrifice and volition. They created this society on their own. They fought wars. Young Jewish men and women died by the many thousands in those wars. They created a society without any help from anyone that really is a vibrant, sovereign society with democratic principles, with all the modern elements that make up any modern state. Now, if the Cheyenne Indians want to do that, I don't have a problem with that. They do have reservations. I would think that they should have more sovereignty if they can achieve it, and if they can do it in a way that is respectful of, the neighbors and in the right context.
Finish your thought.
I just think it's a misnomer to suggest that somehow anyone gave Israel to the Jews. The Jews achieved sovereignty. I hear people even on our side, they say, Israel has a right to exist. No nation has a right to exist. Israel achieved the right to exist through its own sacrifice. It fought wars. It settled land. It built businesses. It welcomed its own people. It developed a state.
I want to take Charles' side. More than that, when Israel became a sovereign state, right, in 48, it's almost like we flipped the switch, and overnight you had all the main institutions of government, of democracy, they were in place. It was like almost like, okay, it's already just like, all right, lights, curtain,
right.
Action. And when the world saw it, people, they were like, they went crazy. It was like, oh my God. So it can be done. So we can create these democracies everywhere. And suddenly at the same time, if you remember, said all those other post-colonial countries which wanted independence started to pop up. But guess what? Almost none of them became a democracy or close to that. So in a way, we were, again, an example of something, but no one could copy that example.
Let's think about that. First of all, it didn't just happen overnight. I mean, modern Zionism developed starting mid-19th century, where they started to build the Hebrew language. They started to develop all the institutions and businesses and farms and all of the rest that would eventually lead to the state. It was very organic. It wasn't just something that popped out of nowhere.
I meant it started work as soon as we got the declaration.
Right.
We were ready to go. We didn't.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go through a civil war and a coup and a this and a that, right?
Well, there was a war, and at that time
there was a lot of stuff happening.
But, yeah.
But we somehow managed to come together and, you know,
and pull it off.
When the declaration came, the country was just working. It was like a working country. You could pay taxes, you could get services. It was amazing.
Right. Absolutely. And the thing is that I get into this as well. The early Arab leaders, not just Emir Faisal bin Hussein, who was the king of Syria and who considered himself to be a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad and who was revered in the Arab and Islamic world, he recognized Israel. He welcomed the Jews to come back to their ancestral land. He referred to us as his cousins. And in many, many letters, right. One that he wrote particularly to Felix Frankfurter, who was the president of Harvard at the time, and he did so not really out of necessarily an altruistic reason, but because he was a nationalist and he wanted Israel as a sovereign Jewish state to help his Arab states emerge as good national entities and states with democracy and technology and all of these great developments that he knew the Jews had developed in Palestine. And he felt that it would be a partnership. And I think that that spirit continues with the Abraham Accords. You know, there are, and I think that the Arab street, as it were, they're anti-Israel because of what I describe as an anti-Semitic imagination. Their corrupt leaders want to distract attention from their own corrupt systems by saying, oh, look at the Israelis, look at the Jews. They're to blame for everything.
Look here.
And it's crazy. I mean, it's even personal. I mean, like, for example, you might remember, I don't know, it was 10 years ago, there were sharks off the coast of Tunisia. Yeah. And the media and the government blamed Israel for this because they were biting people. And I remember there was an Israeli cartoonist who drew sharks with yarmulkes. I mean, it gets that crazy. It's personal. They start to even blame Israel and the Jews for problems in their own personal life. So, you know, it's a massive distraction by these establishments. And if the street in the Arab country woke up, they would recognize that Israel is a country they should emulate for their own people. And befriend.
You're touching on a point. Although you don't live in Israel, I live in Israel right now, but I can ask you, are we a country worth emulating? I don't say it lightly. Don't say like, of course.
I understand.
Really look at the details of this country right now at this point in time, not the one that was founded 70 years.
Or put all the good stuff on one side of the scale and put all the bad stuff on the other side of the scale, and is there more good than bad?
Absolutely. Sure by far. Oh, I'm absolutely sure about that. It's not. It's no utopia. You know, I mean, never was. I mean, it can be very messy at times, and it's certainly far from perfect. But, you know, on the broader scale, Israel is a dynamic, organic society that serves the interests of its own people, and has created.
So what's missing, Charles?
I think that there's still this same rotten international establishment that hates Israel, and on the left, there are two reasons.
Forget about everyone else for a minute. Can we have a great life together? Like, we'll come to everyone else in a minute. Yeah. What's missing for us to have a great life together?
Yeah, we're already fanning the flames of October 6th. Now, as we speak, with still 100, over 100 people in Gaza, and the war's still going on, and the North is this, and America's breathing down our necks, and we're once again, there's forces working really hard to fan the flames of this unity. Even though, as you said, in the army, on the street, maybe masses of people, you're right, are feeling this unity and the power of that unity, but already the forces
there
are
is.
At it.
I mean, look. It's going to take a while for Israel to finish the very difficult and painful job in Gaza of getting rid of Hamas, but they have to do that because it's proven that the Israeli state can't live alongside an entity like that that continues to wage war. That's the basic of rule of war. I mean, St. Thomas Aquinas developed the rules of just war, and this war fits within that construct. Israel has a right to defend itself from this enemy, which has not only declared war against Israel, but has engaged in the most atrocious forms of war against Israel. They can't. They've given Gaza so many chances to live in peace. I mean, they handed.
No, listen, I know, we know it, but you know, the world doesn't seem to know it.
Yeah, I don't care what the world says.
Some form of dementia.
Who cares? I don't. You know, look.
No, I'm with you on the who cares thing, but it's a little scary.
We can't pay attention to that. We have to finish the job there carefully and methodically. Israel has never, this whole idea that Israel's engaging in a genocide, everyone knows that's a lie. I mean, that's a left-wing construct that's put up by Hamas.
The population there grew by 1,200%.
No, it's absurd. That's not to say that Israel couldn't engage in a genocide. Any country could. But they haven't.
Listen, it's tough. I served in the army. You can't take a lot of people who really value life and have them, change software and start like, all right, more death. Yeah, you can find some rotten apples.
It's not perfect.
Crazy, those are the people around me who serve in the army. It's not some other, it's like the U.S. has 300 million citizens and 3 million people are in the army. You may never see them, may never have any contact with them, right? Here in Israel, it's all the people, family members, friends. What do you think, they just turned genocidal overnight? Even the concept is outrageous.
Of course, it's
pull it off.
It's a terrible smear against the Jewish people.
And yet, here we are. People think this way. The world is ostracizing us for this. The EU is calling for a ceasefire without conditions. The America is not vetoing the decision in the Security Council. We're almost back to pre-UN declaration of.
No, but Israel also has a lot of friends in the world, and I think we can't be discouraged. I mean, I'll give the example I mentioned in my book as well. In 1948, the entire establishment in America, the liberal establishment, was against recognizing Israel. Secretary of State Marshall, Secretary of Defense Forrestal, they all told Truman, don't recognize Israel. They've got nothing. They don't have any money. They don't have any oil. We're going to piss off the entire Arab world, which is super oil wealthy and population-wise and resources. It was not a good idea geopolitically. Now, I like the Israelis like to say, well, we're the greatest democracy in the Middle East. We're America's greatest ally. That's actually not really true. I mean, Israel, the United States, it doesn't have an interest in supporting Israel. They probably would have been better off if they'd recognized, the Arab position. But they went ahead, Truman went ahead, almost unilaterally, and he recognized the state of Israel against the advice of the entire rotten internationalist-oriented establishment.
Force compelled him to do so.
I believe it was a divine source, and in fact, that was what was told him by.
He didn't want to be punished in the afterlife, basically.
Well, I think it was Chaim Weizmann who said, your mother put you in your mother's womb. You were put for this purpose, and compared him to Cyrus when he gave him a Torah as a gift, and there wasn't a dry eye in the room. And I think, I also think that Truman was reflecting the American value and the majority of the American people, both liberal and conservative, left and right, Democrat and Republican. The majority of the American people supported the state of Israel because they support the concept of national sovereignty, going back to our own American Revolution, but also because Israel was Jewish and they are Christians and they recognize that we believe in the same God and that they have embraced and adopted what they call the Old Testament, which calls for this. And that it's something that's very ingrained, I think, in this country and I think in most of the world.
So where did we go wrong? I'll ask it differently. Some people think that right now we're going through a very messy period, as you said, and we have to just go through it, not judge the full kind of the whole picture based on this this very messy scene, right? Look beyond. Things eventually will come down. We'll eventually finish the work in Gaza. We'll eventually finish the work with Hezbollah. It will come down here. The elections will come and go in the U.S. Everybody will come down there. Like basically, it's cycles, and we'll hit another sweet spot. Relax, go back to just trading options and drinking margaritas on the beach. Maybe some people are saying no. This is not a just an endless circle. It's more like a spiral. It's spiraling towards something. This is a trajectory, and we're engaged in maybe something that's more like the final act or the first act of a global war, a global change. You know, something really big might be coming down the pipe, and this is just like, as Jews are always the canary in a coal mine, as we like to be called sometimes. This whole radical Islam on Jews is actually really a wake-up call to the potential of radical Islam against the West, basically. Because, you know, once the Jews are out of the picture, what, Americans and Iranians are just going to live happily, you know, right, shoulder to shoulder? No, I mean, it's, something's got to give. So it's almost like, so I wonder, where are you on these two worldviews? Do you see this as a circle, it's just like relax and, you know, head under the waves and move to the next calm period? Or is this really going somewhere, and where is it going?
Well, I mean, I think that Israel has to continue its mission protecting the national sovereignty and the rights and the property and the lives of its own citizens. It doesn't need to apologize to anyone for that. And nothing likes victory. Nothing likes success is always the best strategy. And Israel needs to finish the war, in which case people will be more behind them. But I don't think Israel really needs to worry about it. Now, the people and some of the anti-Semitic commentators on the right that I've been listening to, and some of whom I actually admire, like Stu Peters, for example, definitely anti-Israel and anti-Jewish, but yet a brilliant radio host, and he means well. He sees like Zion, you know, Jews, and he thinks, oh, they're Zionists, which they may or may not be, in influencing the U.S. government and basically trying to push toward a world order. What I would separate here is two things. First of all, yes, maybe they are a part of this international movement, but not necessarily as Jews, more as just these international believers. But the Jewish side of them actually makes a little difference in terms of their support for Zionism, which is not an international movement. They are trying to situate things in such a way that it preserves Israel's existence and Israel's safety. And that's always been part of that agenda, nothing more. That is what it's about for the so-called Zionist side of their personality. But as far as their globalist side of their personality, that he's right about. I can condemn that whether it's Jew or not. That's a dangerous trend. But as far as Israel goes, its mission is simple: preserving its sovereignty and the lives and safety of its people. And they need not apologize for that.
Charles, what do you hope to achieve by writing all these books?
Well, I mean, I hope written, to...
How many did you write so far?
How many have I written? Probably over 20. I mean, I write an average of 2 books a year.
Yeah.
And
I can't write down a single... I could barely write my resume. And my wife says I'm a good writer, but I
urge people to write. I mean, it's in this day and age with the internet, it's actually fairly easy to write a book. If you're passionate about something and you want to do a deep dive and you want to learn about it, there's no better way to do it than writing a book.
Yeah, and your stuff is it's thorough, it's dense material. It can, like, each one is like a what is it called? The reduction sauce. You know, each one's like its own like thing of this piece.
Consommé.
Yeah, but what's the purpose of all of this?
Well, look, I mean, my hope is to wake people up to their own agency, that if they realize that the mission of Israel, the mission of the Jewish people is to be sovereign, to be a kind of like a, you know, we've always been a little bit outside of the normative mainstream. We've been individualists. We've supported our families. We've supported education. You know, we've been loyal to nations. When they're loyal to us, when they're not loyal to us, we're not. And that's a good message for citizens. You know, I mean, we're loyal Americans, but if America starts putting people in jail for political crimes and trying to jail the political opponent and censoring people, we're not for that, at least not as a people. And our opposition to that should inspire other citizens as well.
We usually don't get that message until it's way too late, like this guy Jonathan Glazer, you know, the movie producer.
Oh yeah, uh-huh.
you know, like the Jews are all, you know, there's also this like self-hating Jew through all the generations who thinks that, you know, by criticizing Israel, somehow his life is going to be spared.
Oh, there's always that. There's always been, I mean, we could look through history. Some of the worst enemies of the Jewish people were former Jews. I mean, Torquemada was a former Jew.
We have a book on it. Seth, can you show the book? You have it on you?
I don't have it on me. So we'll feature it, though. But you talk about this for a minute, Charles.
Well, I mean, like, as I said, Torquemada, who was whispering in the ear of Ferdinand and Isabella, he was a former Jew who became the most radical advocate of the Spanish Inquisition. Nicholas Donen was a former Jew who went to the Pope, and he smeared the Talmud, and the Pope basically sent him over to visit Louis the Ninth of France, who burned 13 crates of Talmuds on the grounds of the Chateau de Ville, right on the Seine. It's still there. So, you know, you have former Jews who, I mean, I would argue that you could say that about most of the Bolsheviks, right? I mean, they had turned their back on Judaism, and they'd embraced...
So we can't... Leo and I are refined more and more and more. Like, where's our target? You know, it's at first we're like, okay, you know, we're just going to solve this across the globe. But then it becomes more, I keep using that Empire Strikes Back or whatever it's called thing where Luke has to like drive and just hit that one point in the middle. And then it like, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So we can't deal with every Jew because some Jews are the biggest anti-Semites, like Torquemada. Right.
Right.
So we just need to hit that one spot. We need to reach those Jews that we can, you know, who are interested in this good outcome for us, right? But we have to refine, and not just refine, but like a mother bird, like, or whatever the animal is that chews its food before it feeds it to its young.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
oh, then.
What?
All of them.
But we have to also prepare the message for the audience in a way that's acceptable. Because the way we discuss it, it's like it's very high level, and it has a lot of, you know, we all can hear in this discussion, we can say one thing, you know, you say, and we all kind of know what we're talking about, and we have a lot of backstory to it. We have to present it to these kids on college campuses, or we have to present it to people who are listening to sound bites all day long, you know, from MSNBC or something, in a way that they can all get it.
I mean, you're bringing up, I mean, a really vexing question in terms of how to reach these college kids who are even Jewish college kids who have become anti-Israel. And I think that, look, the left is anti-Israel for two reasons. First of all, because it's capitalist and because it's a startup nation. It's not perfectly capitalist, there's no such thing, but generally it encourages individual initiative and private ownership and enterprise. And of course, the left hates that because it stands in the way of their bizarre view of a world ant colony, of people who are absolute equal. And secondly, because Israel is Jewish, even the secular Israelis, you know, are more, in a way, it's more of a religious nation than any nation in the world today. Maybe there are some positive developments, like, for example, Ireland now is becoming a little bit more religious, which is great. But Israel has really shown the way in terms of that, and that's why it's despised by the left. That's why it's hated and feared by an establishment that wants to turn its back on God and basically create an international order.
Is it because Israel is so connected to God? Is that why the world hates? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, the Jewish people are so connected to God in Israel, and they understand.
What does it mean to be connected to God? What does it mean to be Jewish?
Well, in the case of Israel, by just being
there. Well, you're at it.
Okay. By just being there, they're fulfilling about a third of the mitzvahs of the Torah and Talmud, just by being in the state of Israel. And the principle of God is basically that the Lord God separated himself from when he created the world, he created a secular natural world, and that there's a separation between the natural world that we live in and we know, and the supernatural world, which we don't completely know, but we have a sense of it when we look at the miraculous nature of our own lives, and that we know that there's something bigger to our life than just that we're some bag of bones.
What is it?
It's the soul. It's the spiritual aspect of our life that gives us a greater purpose.
If it goes right, if people listen to the message and they do it, then what's good? What good's going to happen?
They're going to become more aware of their own personal agency in the world. They're going to listen to their own voice inside and realize that they have a special mission, and that they also are going to become more aware of all the lies that surround us. And they'll be able to make a better discernment in terms of what those lies are and what are the motivations behind them. They'll become aware of the fact that as images of God, they're commanded to take care of themselves first, as in terms of self-interest, that that's a value. And out of that comes family and helping others. There's a lot of basic functions that people are going to become aware of that are part of our nature, that are even part of the animal kingdom. I mean, even animals know this. Animals understand property. Try to get in the face of a dog. You'll realize that dog knows his property. I mean, these are natural elements that we need to become aware of. And the way to do that is an internal listening to yourself and prayer in some form. It doesn't necessarily have to be the formal Jewish form, which is wonderful, but just an awareness that you have to learn how to walk with God. And I mean, that's really kind of what I have to say about it.
So I think, you know, there's this relationship we describe, and there's the state of the world that we described, and then there's, you know, I didn't get like a direct answer from you, but
yeah,
I can kind of infer that you are suggesting that this is moving towards something. It's not simply an endless cycle where we have to just relive this nightmare every 50 years or so, and you know, this is life. But maybe it is moving towards something. What can, and especially when you talk about the sense of agency. So I want to bring the attention to that. So someone hearing this doesn't leave thinking, okay, all right, this is a good discussion. I got to get back to work, right? Like,
yeah.
How can a Jewish person first, or anyone feeling Jewish, as Seth and I like to say, we say being a Jew is a desire. It's not a religion. It's not a, you know, it's not an ethnicity. It's not a, you know, nationality, even. It's a desire that you have toward that, achieving that goal, toward attaining that connection with the highest force in nature, the force of love. That's where we need to be going. That's where nature is pushing us to go. But nature needs some people in the big network of humanity to sort of act as conduits, as guides, as, you know, right, as go-betweens, right?
Right.
Between that part and that part. So, again, sounds good on paper, but what should a regular person who has that desire, or I have a desire, I want peace, I want a better world, I want to connect with this higher force of love, it sounds great, why not, who wouldn't, right? What can we do? What can they do? What should they do? Should they be thinking about something, talking about something, doing something? Should they all, you know, buy a Torah and start reading and put a kippah? Like, what should they do? Like, what's the story here for the regular person, confused person, I might say?
Well, I mean, look, we all can ascribe to live by all of the moral and ethical precepts of Jewish life that are described very specifically in the Torah and developed in the Talmud. Now, nobody can achieve that totally. And we may not want to achieve elements of it, but we can at least look at it as a blueprint for how we are to live. And one of the basic themes there is that the Torah does separate good from evil, the sacred from the profane, and it does separate all kinds of things, men from women, nation states, property, how to govern, how to create a moral society based on a whole intricate level of separations. I think the United States reflects that in our concept of separation of powers and checks and balances. It's an understanding that in order to have a balanced society and a balanced universe, we need to balance all of these different diverse and different aspects of life so that they have a certain equilibrium that becomes more natural. We have a self-interest in protecting our neighbor, loving our neighbor as ourself, not because we necessarily agree with that person, but because by loving our neighbor, we are protecting our own lives. It's a balance that it's inherent in balancing any society from its hard, extreme edges. And it creates a sort of an organic and natural way by which we as individuals can achieve our own destiny and our own life. And I think that all of that blueprint is in the Torah. Again, you don't have to live by every element of it, but to study it and to understand it gives you a blueprint for what you should advocate for in your own life and in public, in politics.
Okay.
I was muted. Oh, sorry, I was muted. I don't envy the leaders of China, for example, right? You have like 1 billion people and you have to manage a society of 1 billion people. So inevitably, you have to, I mean, some people are not going to be happy. Like, it's just impossible to manage 1 billion people, right? Like, if it turns out that we need a road for the good of the whole country here, it doesn't matter that you had 100 generations of your family living there. Like, you're moving because we're putting a road or whatever it is. If you manage 1 billion people, it's a very big issue, right? And probably takes a lot of force. The Jews, on the other hand, it's a very, 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 very small group, right? So it should, and it's more like a family, right? So, and even within that, like right away, there's some we don't need to worry about so much because they're not really causing too much harm and they're kind of going to go along with it. And other ones are so far extreme that we're not going to reach them anyway. So right away, like I'm just going based on what you just said about this rules of the Torah, of whatever that means, like, we're like very much tachlis, like we want to do it, you know, not just to talk about it. And the good thing about us Jews is like, good thing, we don't have a lot of us, you know. It shouldn't be that difficult. It shouldn't be that difficult for a bunch of us to do this.
Shouldn't, but.
Well, I mean, look, it's sort of, you mentioned like the family. I mean, sometimes in sociology, it's a good idea to bring something down to a very basic element. And we can look at the family, look at our own families. I'm looking at my family. We don't necessarily get along so well. We have conflicts. We don't like each other in some cases. We don't agree. But in the bigger picture, whether it be an external force or an internal problem, we will come together and help each other in those times. So in a way, it's sort of like, you know, there doesn't have, I mean, I guess you could also compare it to a football game. Football has its rules. It has its goalposts. It has its field. But once those rules are established, then it's every man for himself. They kick the ball and off you go. So, you know, maybe this is getting into the question of like what Adam Smith talked about with the hidden hand of the economy or whatnot. And we should note that he was also a theologian. But it's kind of like the individual freedom under God also has to comport with the interests of a public society. You know, if that means building a road that benefits everyone, then that can mean that. I mean, there are national interests.
Let's start even smaller. Like you're getting really big picture again. Like, let's start with, what would an implementation of this be in a practical way, like not with having to like recruit politicians and raise a ton of money, like tomorrow, you know?
I don't think there has to be anything implemented. I think it's natural. You know, we have elected representative government that reflects our values, but that operates within a set of rules. It's called the Constitution, just like the football team operates in the goalposts. And once we establish that, we have the right ultimately to make our own choices, and we promote individual rights and individual sovereignty.
So I'll rephrase the question a little bit, make it a little more, maybe more specific. In your mind, right now,
yeah,
the rules are set, everything is great, we just have to sort of work within those. Is there anything that we need to do different than how we were doing it, maybe up until now, up until the 7th? I mean, is there something for me as a Jew, whether in Israel or the U.S. today, that I have to change? Do I have to change anything? This is the magic word. Everybody talks about change. Nobody wants to write anything about changing anything. It's scary. It takes energy, resources, time, money. I don't have time for this. Maybe tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe my kids. So seriously, is everything, are we just going to continue doing the same thing, being the same, Jews that we're generally good people, right? Continue in this kind of, or do you need to change?
Let's also say that if we, you know, get a couple hundred thousand people, you know, it's probably enough to start the wildfire of what we could bring to the, of the, all of the good we could bring. Like, we don't need like to get to a billion people right away. We just need this kind of critical mass to spread this through, because everything we do through technology, through medicine, through politics, through Hollywood, it spreads. So we just need to harness this critical mass and get this cooking between us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very frustrated. I think Leo might also be frustrated. Like, how?
I'm also concerned a little bit for my own safety.
No, of course.
Charles, what's happening?
Well, look, I mean, I think that we have to get back to some of the basic principles of Judaism that we all have to acknowledge, whether we agree with them or not. And they were very well espoused by the late Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi of Great Britain, where he, my memory is a little faulty here, I get into this in my book, but he talks about the principles being creation, nationhood, and redemption. Or, in, you know, creation, sovereignty in the world, and redemption. The idea of creation recognizes that there is a God that is outside of human nature and that created the universe and created each of us in his image. Then once we have that knowledge, we can then identify that which is true and that which is false. We have that ability as human beings to a certain extent. And that the way to find redemption is to live by those principles, to find what is right, and then to choose the good. And if we choose the good, then we'll get rewards. If we don't choose the good, then we'll have karmic negativity in our lives and in our effects on others. So,
expecting,
I mean,
you to solve all our problems today, Charles.
No, I'm not trying to solve anything. I mean, I'm just saying.
No. That's why you're here, Charles.
Oh, I see. Right. Yeah, sure.
I thank you for being here, because it reminded me that, like, how quickly we get into the heat of the conversation. I like
Indeed.
It. We don't need to beat about the bush. There's definitely an issue here, and I think we're sort of seeing the same thing, except maybe Charles is more of a. Even more of an optimist than us, you know, and I consider myself an optimist, but still, yeah. It sounds like you're maybe more of a rounded approach to it, which I like. I wonder if we could read for us a quote. I found a quote from Rav Kook. I don't have a quote from Rabbi Sacks. It was great, but I found a quote from Rav Kook. Maybe you can read that. That would be nice. It kind of sums up a little bit of our discussion. Read that, and then we'll bring it home. We'll wrap it up.
Okay. I don't have a quote from Rav Kook.
No, I have it. I put it in the chat.
Oh, here it is. Let me just, do I see that? Where is that? I don't think I have access.
On the bottom bar, there's a button. Says
there's
chat.
A button. Okay, here we go. Thank you. Excuse my, like, clumsiness on these matters.
Okay.
I forget it. I mean, I've done programs on my podcast where I forgot to push the tape button. I'm not seeing it anyway. You might as well read it anyway. So what is the quote?
I want Charles to read it. Hold on.
I think he's saying he can't find it.
Yeah, but I'm not finding it.
The chat button? Oh, wait, on the window that we're
I see like a transcription here.
No. On the window, you see a microphone icon on the left?
A microphone icon. No, I don't think. Oh,
well, how do you mute and unmute?
Let me just see here. Yeah, I see the mute button.
Good. Next to it, there's a camera.
Yes.
Next to it, there's like a security shield.
Right.
Next to it, participants.
Yes.
Next to it, chat.
Chat. Let me click that. Ah, there we go. Thank you. Only when the principle of love is exercised in Israel will complete peace and faithful love come, and the pure feeling of recognizing the brotherhood between people and will develop. When that development is completed within us, at a degree that merits being a role model to many, all the nations will recognize it, and the blessing of peace will begin to dwell in the world. Yeah, beautiful.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good goal, right? It's a good goal
just
to be an example. Yeah, you don't have to even work that hard. You have
to be a light unto the nations, right?
Yeah, no, but actually be that example. I think we think that being a light means like I have to explain to you why I'm
no,
the light.
It's how we live our lives is the light.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly. So, Charles, any final words? The whole Jewish nation is listening to you. Any. If you have their ear for 30 seconds.
Just keep the faith. You know, don't listen to the naysayers on the far left and the far right. Know who we are. Stay the course. You know your own agency. Be prayerful. Believe in God. And, you know, the good will prevail over the evil.
Nice. That's very nice. I'll close by saying that I'll kind of reference your book. I think just like there's an anti-Semitic imagination, we need to have a good Jewish imagination. I think that's what we're lacking.
Indeed.
We can have a good, united Jewish imagination. If we can once again dream the same dream together, I think we can do some amazing stuff. We're just, we forgot the power of our own dreams when they're united. So I invite everyone. I think Seth is joining me in that as well. Everyone, you know, let's dream something together, something nice together. And until then, you can find The Anti-Semitic Imagination, The Great Establishment Deception by Charles Moskowitz on Amazon. And we'll put the link under the description of this show. And as usual, like, comment, subscribe, hit the bell to get notifications. We're doing lives on Sunday. We try to be consistent. Work with us here.
Mm-hmm.
But we're trying to be here every Sunday live or with some amazing guests. And join our circle. We're the Jew Function. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you, Leo and Seth. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Have a great day. Keep the good fight.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time.
Okay. Bye-bye.